Hey everyone, I'm Callie Crossley in for Tanzina this week. We start with the all-important Senate runoff races in Georgia.
For the first time, voters in urban counties in Georgia voted at a higher rate than the rural rest of the state. And that's a trend that worries Republicans.
Also on the show, with President Trump recently pardoning his loyalists, we'll talk about the legal aspects of the moves.
A bad pardon is the use of a pardon in such a way as to undermine our judicial system by, in a sense, telling people, if you know someone in the White House, you'll get away with it.
And we'll round out the show talking to director Brian Fogel about his recent film, The Dissident, about the murder of Jamal Khashoggi and what his death says about the safety of press freedom globally. It's The Takeaway for Monday, December 28th. We start today in Georgia, where in just about a week, the state will hold two Senate runoffs that will determine which party will control the U.S. Senate. In one race, Republican incumbent David Perdue will face Democrat John Ossoff. And in the other, Republican incumbent Kelly Loeffler faces Democrat Raphael Warnock. Democrats need to win both seats to take control of the Senate, while Republicans need to hold on to just one. While Georgia has not elected a Democratic senator in 20 years, demographic changes put the state in the Democrats' column at the presidential level this year for the first time in almost 30 years. And as the state has become the center of the political universe, almost $500 million worth of ads have flooded Georgia's airwaves. The results of this race will also determine, in part, the Biden administration's ability to forge ahead with its agenda. Joining me from Atlanta to discuss the latest is Tia Mitchell, Washington correspondent with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and Stephen Fowler, politics reporter with Georgia Public Broadcasting and host of the podcast Battleground Ballot Box. Tia, Stephen, good to have you with us.
Hey, thanks.
Thanks for having us.
Stephen, I want to start with you. What we know about what the turnouts looks like at this stage in the race and how that tracks with the general election and past runoff elections. I'm hearing there's a huge turnout.
That's right. What we're seeing is not typical of a runoff. You know, usually people vote in the main election, and if there is a runoff, not that many people come out. And the ones that do are typically older and whiter, and in Georgia, favor Republicans. Well, we are getting very, very close to the general election turnout so far. We've got about 2 million people that have already cast a ballot through the mail or through in-person early voting. And that's almost at the same level as we had in the general election. And what this means, looking at the data, is you are seeing more Black voters in Georgia's southwest corner of the state that are the backbone of the Democratic Party. You're seeing more suburban and urban voters in Metro Atlanta voting at the same race as they did in the general election. And what you're not seeing is people in Georgia's Republican base in the northwest and northeast corners of the state showing up to vote early, but they typically vote on election day. So it still remains to be seen. You can't necessarily read the tea leaves into who's going to be favored come polls closing.
Is it true more than 70,000 people have registered to vote?
That's right. Since Georgia's November election cutoff, which is about mid-October, there have been tens of thousands of new people that have registered to vote in this runoff, and many of those have already cast a ballot. Additionally, some of the people that have voted early in this election didn't vote in November, didn't vote in our presidential primary. So that adds another big question mark as to who benefits from that, of new people coming into the fold, seeing those hundreds of millions in advertisement and getting out the vote.
Tia, in several House races that culminated in November, Republicans painted their opponents as socialists who would support an uber progressive agenda in Washington. And for many of them, that strategy worked. Senators Loeffler and Perdue are using the same strategy. Do you think it will work?
So it's interesting because Georgia was a little bit off of that trend in the House races, because in Georgia, we had one toss-up House race in suburban Atlanta that was won by Democrat Carolyn Bordeaux. She's the only Democrat in the nation that flipped a seat from red to blue this cycle, because we know Democrats had a lot of losses and didn't pick up seats they thought they could, and she was their one bright spot. And she faced those allegations of being too liberal and too radical, and she still managed to win. Lucy McBath managed to defend her seat, even though her opponent made those same attacks. So in Georgia, that trend didn't hold as true. That being said, you're right. Leffler and Perdue are waging those same attacks against John Ossoff, against Reverend Warnock, and more pronounced, even more so, against Reverend Warnock. And I think that is a play, again, to their base, to get conservative voters to turn out and to hopefully help them defend those seats. But the question is, in Georgia, I'm not sure if the pattern in Georgia shows that that really pays off in energizing voters to the degree that's needed, at least in suburban Atlanta. And that's really where Republicans need that turnout, need those moderate, suburban, college-educated voters to vote with Republicans.
Nevertheless, since the November general, around $500 million has been spent on ads across Georgia. Now, what about the content of these ads and the sort of impact they're having on these voters?
Republicans are describing Warnock and Ossoff as radical liberals with ties to communism and ties to China. And they're taking Reverend Warnock's old sermons and including snippets out of context that make him sound, you know, anti-American and anti-Israel. And they've accused him of things like supporting Fidel Castro. But on the other side, you have Democrats with attack ads that are repainting the Republicans as, you know, ultra rich and greedy and accusing them of profiting off the pandemic and not doing enough to help average Americans during the pandemic. So it's been a lot of really scary doom and gloom stuff from the attack ads. And then, of course, the candidates themselves have ads that are trying to introduce themselves to voters in a way that is much more benevolent. You know, we have Reverend Warnock with his puppy and things like that. Joe Biden cut an ad that says he needs Warnock and Ossoff. So the ads are, at this point, kind of overwhelming. You know, I was watching football last night, and, you know, even every ad break, there were attack ads, and then there were these nice ads with David Perdue smiling at you and saying, please vote for me. So, again, it's about turnout, but at this point, it's kind of very saturated. The ads have saturated everything, radio, TV, digital, in people's mailboxes.
Stephen, Leffler's ads in particular seem to have struck a nerve. Recently, a group of African-American pastors calling Leffler's ads a, quote, broader attack against the Black church and faith traditions for which we stand, unquote. Have Leffler's ads backfired?
You know, I think it's really hard to say because Kelly Leffler is saying, no, I'm just pointing out Raphael Warnock and calling him a radical liberal and doing things, but you can't separate the sermons of a Black pastor from Black theology and the Black church. And especially in the South, I think it fails to gain traction because, you know, a Baptist preacher in the South tends to speak for a lot more people than, say, many other states because we are in the middle of the Bible Belt. You contrast that, these ads calling him a radical liberal, with what Raphael Warnock has put out, you know, him struggling with Christmas tree lights, you know, him walking a dog and throwing out dog poop and comparing Leffler's ads to a bunch of dog poop. And it just doesn't really land in the same way that you would expect maybe in some other races with some other candidates and some other issues.
Well, Tia, President Trump and his surrogates in Georgia have continued to hold events and claim that the election was stolen from him and that they should continue to fight to overturn the results. Does this strategy of standing by these unfounded conspiracy theories hurt Leffler and Perdue with white moderate voters, the ones that were turned off by Trumpism during the general?
I think that definitely hurts with moderate voters who are becoming more and more turned off to Trump. However, the message that Leffler and Perdue and their supporters are trying to send is that Trump is going to be gone. Do you want Democrats to control the House, the Senate, and the White House? Because if you do, they're going to do things that you don't like that have nothing to do with President Trump, your taxes, your healthcare, the military and policing and law enforcement. So in a way, there's this messaging about Loeffler and Perdue that without directly contradicting President Trump or downing him in any way, they kind of say, what do we want post-Trump? That being said, Loeffler and Perdue are still working very hard to curry favor with President Trump. So it's sometimes that messaging creates conflict. And that conflict doesn't necessarily speak to the moderates as much as that conflict speaks to those conservatives, those Trump MAGA conservatives that follow Trump to a T. And so that's why Loeffler and Perdue want to keep Trump on their side, because there's a portion of the party that is going to follow what Trump tells them to do. And right now he's telling them to vote for Perdue and Loeffler, but we know that can turn on a dime, and they're working really hard to make sure that doesn't happen. But that's kind of two different segments of the Republican Party.
Two things there. One, when you're talking about the Atlanta suburbs and who those suburban voters are, increasingly, it's not white moderates. Georgia's suburban population has exploded by well over a million voters in the last several years, and it's increasingly younger, increasingly diverse, and increasingly Democratic. That said, Perdue and Loeffler are caught between Scylla and Charybdis here, a rock and a hard place, because they have to curry favor with the president. They have to acknowledge that he is fighting and he's trying to overturn the election results while also having to not turn off those voters. And so you've seen plenty of uncomfortable situations, like a rally that the president had down in South Georgia, where David Perdue was shouted down by people at the rally saying fight for Trump while he was trying to tell the president that he was his number one supporter and fighting for him. And so come January 20th, when Joe Biden is inaugurated president, it's going to be a really, really awkward conversation if Perdue and Loeffler win, because they had to convince enough people that Trump was maybe still going to be president, that they should still vote for them to still be in the Senate. And it just is an impossible threading of the needle that these senators are trying to do. And it remains to be seen whether enough people believe them.
The national political analysts seem to think that it's really the make or break areas are the rural voters. What do you say? And is this why President Trump is making a trip to Georgia next week?
For the first time, voters in urban counties in Georgia voted at a higher rate than the rural rest of the state. And that's a trend that worries Republicans. If you look at Georgia's early voting data so far, 2.1 million people have already cast their ballot. Most of those are in metropolitan areas of the state that tend to vote more Democratic. The two congressional districts that lag far behind are rural Northeast Georgia, which is represented by Doug Collins, and Northwest Georgia, who is soon to be represented by Marjorie Taylor Greene, a polarizing, conspiracy-touting member who is leading the charge to challenge the election results. President Trump is going to Northwest Georgia the day before the election. It's where Marjorie Taylor Greene represents. It's where the lowest turnout is so far, and none of those are coincidences.
Tia, what about those rural voters? Do you think they can give President Trump the advantage he needs?
They can if they turn out. The question is, will they? Especially because it's been almost 2 months now that they've been told your vote wasn't counted accurately, the system is rigged. For many rural voters who are Trump supporters, that's who they're listening to, and they're getting misinformation. If that keeps them home because they don't believe in the integrity of the election, or they don't believe that Perdue and Loeffler have done enough to earn their vote, if they don't think Perdue and Loeffler are doing enough to defend President Trump, then they're saying, well, why should we vote for them? And we've seen people like Attorney Lynn Wood say, don't vote for Perdue and Loeffler. They haven't done enough to help President Trump. And so we don't want to reward them with sending them to Washington. That being said, again, Perdue and Loeffler supporters and by and large, the Republican establishment, including President Trump, have said, listen, yeah, we think the system's rigged. Yeah, we think the election was stolen from President Trump, but we still need you to vote anyways. And it's kind of that mixed messaging, that dual messaging, threading the needle that Stephen referred to. But that's what they're trying to do. And the question is, will that work? And we won't know, like Stephen said, until Election Day, because, again, part of that messaging is absentee balloting is no longer the preferred method of voting for the Republican Party, which is a very recent change. But as a result, you are seeing rural conservative voters waiting until Election Day. So it's hard to read the tea leaves this early, knowing that some of those voters may wait until January 5th if they're going to vote at all.
When do you think we can expect to have the final result?
Right. It might take a while, especially if it's close. Georgia does not allow absentee ballots to be counted early. They can be processed early, but they cannot be counted early. So, you know, those ballots can come in as late as the day of the election, and then overseas ballots even get extra time. So if it's close, you know, and those absentee ballots need to be counted, it could take several days for a winner to emerge, just like in the general election. And again, that doesn't mean anything is wrong. That doesn't mean that the election's being rigged or stolen from any candidate. It just means it may take time to determine a winner if it's close.
So, Stephen, the recent stimulus package back and forth, President Trump finally signed it, but he complained about it, said he wanted changes. What impact is that going to have on the race, particularly since candidate David Perdue has made a point of saying we passed the stimulus, or Republicans and me and President Trump passed the stimulus?
Right. So Perdue put out an ad touting the coronavirus relief package, $900 billion in relief, that started airing before President Trump signed the bill. John Ossoff's campaign demanded TV stations take down that ad because Trump didn't sign it. Now that Trump did sign it, the Perdue campaign says, just like we said, here's this relief we delivered for you in Georgia. And so I think if there is such a thing as an undecided voter, or maybe a voter who needs more motivation to vote versus not vote, I think that is going to be one topic that is going to hit Georgians and make them make their choice. Unemployment benefits are something that is important to Georgia as they recover economically from the coronavirus pandemic. The $600 checks, or maybe $2,000 checks, who knows, we'll see, is going to be a big issue that sticks in people's minds, maybe as we head into this last week of early voting. And it really just boils down to Democrats believe that Republicans are corrupt and working for themselves and not doing things for the American people and the people of Georgia. And Republicans say, look, this is the type of leadership and relief that you'll get if you send us back to the Senate. So when it boils down to it, it really is going to be not the one difference maker in this election, but I think you can take the trends of how the discussions go this week as a sign of how Georgia reacts.
It's fair to say that President Trump's polarizing persona galvanized both Republicans and Democrats to the polls for differing reasons. Without him being at the top of the ticket, motivating Democrats to remove him from office, do Democrats in Georgia have a chance? Stephen, first you.
Well, I think Trump still is on the ballot. Even though his name is not there, his presence looms large. He's holding this big rally the night before the election. He's dictated policy positions for Perdue and Loeffler and other things. So I think he and his legacy is still very much a motivating factor for president or for Democratic voters, especially because electing Ossoff and Warnock would give Joe Biden the bandwidth to do more of his legislative policies he wants in his first couple of years. So the stakes are incredibly, incredibly high. And though voters will not be voting for or against President Trump on the ballot per se, you know, he's the only game in town.
President Trump's the leader of the Republican Party. Both Senator Perdue and Senator Loeffler support President Trump and say they want to serve as a firewall to help protect his legacy in the U.S. Senate. So, yes, this election in many ways is about President Trump and how empowered President-elect Biden will be to steer a new course, or if, you know, the Senate remains in Republican control and can help protect a lot of the things that President Trump put in motion.
Stephen, Tia, thank you for taking the time to join us. Tia Mitchell is a Washington correspondent with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and Stephen Fowler is a politics reporter with Georgia Public Broadcasting.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Last week, President Trump pardoned or commuted dozens of people. The list included former Republican congressmen convicted of campaign fraud and other charges, and numerous people convicted as part of the Mueller investigation, including Roger Stone and Paul Manafort. The president also pardoned Charles Kushner, the father of his son-in-law, as well as four military contractors convicted of killing Iraqi civilians. The DOJ worked on the latter case for years and drew fierce criticism from Iraqis and U.S. officials. The majority of the president's pardons in his term have been those of supporters and loyalists to the president, and more are expected. Larry Coopers is here to talk about this process and the president's circumventing of the Department of Justice. He's former acting pardon attorney under President Trump and former deputy pardon attorney under President Obama. Larry, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And here to discuss the historical roots of the pardon and how other presidents have used it is presidential historian and professor of history and public service at NYU, Tim Naftali. Tim, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Tim, these latest rounds of pardons are being hit hard, even by some Republicans like Pat Toomey. What makes them so tough to stomach for some, and where do they compare historically with past pardons?
Well, President Trump is not the first president to issue what one might think of as a bad pardon. In 1925, the Supreme Court, in a case called Ex parte Grossman, about an innkeeper who violated prohibition, sort of defined a bad pardon. And a bad pardon is the use of a pardon in such a way as to undermine our judicial system by, in a sense, telling people, if you know someone in the White House, you'll get away with it. And there are have been examples of past presidents misusing the pardon. Pardoning of Mark Rich by Bill Clinton. George Herbert Walker Bush's pardoning of a group of associates involved in the Iran-Contra scandal at the end of his term. John F. Kennedy pardoning a Truman-era Politico who had taken a bribe. But these were isolated incidents. They weren't right, but in the context of all the pardons issued by these presidents, they were outliers. In the case of Donald Trump, at least, and it's a back-of-the-envelope calculation, at least 25% so far of his pardons have been self-dealing friends, allies, or people engaged in fraud, whether securities fraud or tax cheating or campaign fraud. And so it's the character of the entire enterprise which makes his approach to the pardon stand out.
Larry, as I understand it, pardons go through a vetting process under the Department of Justice and then are recommended to the president. Did that happen with this most recent round of pardons from President Trump?
No, I've seen one calculation where it's over 80% of the grants of clemency from Trump have not gone through the Department of Justice. And I agree with Tim. What's unique here is that President Trump, both in procedure and in substance, has been abusing the pardon power since he started. It started very early. Sheriff Arpaio was one of the first who was convicted of contempt of court, yet was pardoned, and it's continued to this day.
You worked in the pardon office under both Obama and Trump. What was the difference between the two administrations?
Could not be more different. Under President Obama, the protocol was followed. The applications went through the Department of Justice. The only exception were some pardons and commutations for a small group of Iranians that had to do with the political dealings with Iran at that time. Otherwise, everything went through pardon attorney's office up to the deputy attorney general and then to the White House.
Here's a big question. What if President Trump decides to pardon himself, Tim?
Well, that would be an interesting constitutional challenge. He would be the first president to do it. He wouldn't be the first president to consider doing it. Richard Nixon and his associates, at least his chief of staff, Alexander Haig, contemplated it. Their Justice Department, or Nixon's Justice Department, actually wrote a memo. The Office of Legal Counsel produced a memo that argued that it would not be constitutional. The president could not pardon himself. And that decision, or that interpretation, let us say, by the OLC, I think figured in Nixon's ultimate decision not to pardon himself. Also, the fact that Nixon understood he'd lost the Supreme Court. He just lost a huge case, U.S. v. Nixon, regarding the tapes. So if Donald Trump tried to pardon himself, I think it would be tested. And I'm not sure that the Supreme Court would rule in his favor.
Larry, is there a way to challenge that if he decides to pardon himself?
That's the trick. If he pardons himself, the question is, will they prosecute him for federal crimes after he leaves office? And my take on it is that if he pardons himself, that would be considered so egregious that it would trigger a federal prosecution that might otherwise not happen, so that he'd be shooting himself in the foot by pardoning himself. He would then be prosecuted. Then the issue would come up before the court, probably go to the Supreme Court because it's an issue of first impression. And my bet is that the Supreme Court would rule no self-pardons.
Tim, what do you think about the impact of pardoning military contractors convicted of killing Iraqi civilians? What will that impact be?
Well, it's a stain on all of us, but mainly it's a stain on our military. It suggests that our military condones war crimes. So I think it's a slap at our military justice system, and it further weakens us around the world. I mean, we at the moment are so weak around the world. We seem to be this bully, this unethical bully and hapless bully as a result of the Trump years. And I think that this just, how can we maintain the posture that we are helping other countries build democracy if we are pardoning our killers amongst them? So I think this is terrible for our military, for our international prestige, and it's just one more reason why we'll need a complete redo of our foreign policy posture after January 20th.
Larry, what about the pardons of President Trump's friends, like the Republican Congress members and those convicted during the Mueller investigation? Doesn't pardoning them invalidate the justice system?
Yes, it does. And of course, all of these people were convicted in a federal prosecution, were shown to be guilty. And sometimes the justice system goes wrong, and it's important to use the clemency power to correct it. But in these cases, the grants of clemency serve none of the purposes of the pardon power, which is mercy, forgiveness, and reconciliation. In fact, they go the other way. They basically trigger more conflict, because most of his grants of clemency have been for the purpose of exciting his base, his partisan base.
So, Larry, Tim has suggested that President Biden has to address this, as he mentioned, after January 20th. How do you think the pardons will change under President Biden?
Again, it's going to be night and day. President-elect Biden was, of course, vice president under President Obama when they did the clemency initiative, which was a recognition that the pardon power had to be used in an exceptional and bold way because of the injustices over the past 35 years of federal convictions and federal sentencing. I think there's a possibility for another clemency initiative. I am hoping that will be the case, because there are so many sentences that are too severe, that were imposed in a racially disparate way, and that need to be corrected through clemency. Usually you want criminal justice reform to go through Congress, but sometimes you have to use the clemency power in a more expansive way. And I think this is the time to do so until we correct so many of these overly severe and racially disparate sentences.
Tim Naftali is a presidential historian and professor at NYU, and Larry Coopers worked in the pardon attorney's office for both President Trump and Obama. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Callie Crossley, in for Tanzina Vega. On October 2, 2018, Washington Post columnist and Saudi dissident Jamal Khashoggi walked into the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. He was there to obtain documents for his upcoming marriage to his fiancée. He would never make it out. Reports of Khashoggi's murder and the overwhelming evidence that the Saudi government, including Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, were responsible for his murder, took the world by storm. More than 2 years later, Khashoggi's murderers have still not been brought to justice, and the lives of journalists around the world continue to be threatened. This year, 42 journalists and media workers were killed, according to the International Federation of Journalists. The murder of Jamal Khashoggi and why the repressive Saudi regime wanted to silence him is the subject of the new documentary, The Dissident, the latest film from the Academy Award-winning director, Brian Fogel. The film is now in theaters and will be available on demand on January 8th. But several streaming services passed on releasing the film, and Fogel has said the film's criticism of the Saudi government may be why. I spoke with Brian about the film and why Jamal Khashoggi's murder continues to capture the attention of the world.
He was a Washington Post journalist. Of course, his history was as a Saudi journalist, but in the last year of his life, he was writing for the Washington Post. So as his murder happened, of course, the news stories around the world was he was a Washington Post journalist. I think that certainly attributed to the visibility. But I think even more importantly than that was the brazenness of this crime. Somebody walking into their own consulate seeking wedding papers while their fiance is waiting outside for them, only, to never come out again. And then for us to find out that he had in fact been murdered, dismembered, just a horrific situation. So I think there were a lot of elements that really catapulted this story to the top of news feeds. And then, of course, the kingdom itself and the repression going on within Saudi Arabia that at the same time was being heavily marketed and promoted that Mohammed bin Salman was this great reformer, changing Saudi Arabia, opening up Saudi Arabia, allowing human rights, women's rights, when that narrative was actually propaganda.
Let's unpack a little bit of what you've said here. So first, as you've said, Jamal Khashoggi was known as a Washington Post columnist, but he was a journalist in Saudi Arabia for many years. What was his role as a journalist in Saudi Arabia, and how much press freedom do journalists in Saudi Arabia have?
Well, interestingly enough, as Mohammed bin Salman took power as this great reformer, what Jamal had thought was that there would be a whole increase in press freedom. And in fact, that became completely repressive. I mean, Jamal's background for most of his life is he was kind of a liaison between the kingdom and Washington. He had, in fact, an apartment in Washington, D.C. And one of the main reasons why when he went into self-exile, he chose to go to Washington because he had already been going back and forth to Washington for many years of his life. He would write for the kingdom, but that doesn't mean that it's a free press. You're essentially writing the narrative of the Saudi kingdom. As he went into self-exile and started writing for the Post, he was able to start speaking freely for the first time in his life, and that got him in trouble with Mohammed bin Salman. But I think on an overall level, there really is no press freedom in Saudi Arabia. If you watch The Dissident, gets into that in the film, which is that Saudi Arabia controls the public sphere. They do it through Twitter and other platforms. And basically, free speech is a crime. I mean, speaking against Mohammed bin Salman can wind you up in jail, tortured. On top of there was 800 beheadings in the kingdom last year. Most of those tied to peaceful forms of dissent.
What drives the edge of the seat tension in your film are how you piece together the motives behind his murder. So why did the Saudi government view Khashoggi as such a threat?
They viewed him as a threat because he was no longer able to be controlled. Here was a 60-year-old respected writer, philosopher, thinker, journalist who was an insider. He had 1.7 and a half million Twitter followers at the time of his murder. He was writing for the Washington Post, an American paper. He was writing that he didn't think that that the relationship between Trump and MBS was a healthy one. And he was also taking to social media, basically commenting that a lot of what Mohammed bin Salman was doing, he didn't agree with, including his crackdown in the Ritz-Carlton, where MBS rounded up members of his family and the wealthy of Saudi Arabia and shook them down for billions of dollars. It was a mafia operation. At the same time, cracking down on dissent and freedom and opinion in a way, according to Jamal and others, that have never been experienced in the kingdom. You know, you look at the case of Lujan al-Hatoul, I mean, the Saudi woman's human rights activist. I mean, she's 31 years old. She was imprisoned when she was 28 years old. Her crime was literally suggesting that women should not have to wear a full burqa, that they should be able to, you know, choose their clothing. I mean, still wear a hijab, but not be in that sort of dress if they don't want to be. And that women should be allowed to leave their house without the permission of an 18-year-old male. Meaning women still cannot leave their home in Saudi Arabia unless an 18-year-old male, their son or otherwise, gives them permission. She also was advocating for women to drive. And despite Mohammed bin Salman actually granting that, she is in prison and she's facing 20 years. She's been tortured. So you go, okay, well, how on one hand can you be this reformer? And on the other hand, you have people like Lujan al-Hatoul sitting in a prison tortured. And stories like this go on and on and on and on and on. And so Jamal saw these things happening within his country, while at the same time, the narrative to the West and to Europe was that Saudi was a great reformer. So I think in Jamal's writings, especially in the Western media, especially as he had started to take to Twitter and started working with Omar Abdulaziz, the young Saudi activist who was living in self-exile in Montreal that we get into in the film, he's really the protagonist of the film. You know, he was increasing the ire of the Saudi administration, and they viewed him as someone that needed to be silenced.
There are so many chilling details in the documentary, and it amazes me, frankly, that Khadija Chengiz, Jamal Khashoggi's fiance, is a big part of this film and agreed to be in it. Wasn't it traumatizing for her to relive all of this?
I worked with Khadija for over a year. And when I first met her, it was about a month following the murder in Istanbul. And about the first 5 weeks that I was in Istanbul, we didn't shoot. It was just building trust, building a relationship, and watching her over, you know, what has now been 2 years, go from not speaking English to being fluent in English, really doing her best to take the world stage, fight for justice for Jamal. I mean, COVID has really put a damper in a lot of those efforts. You know, she's an extraordinarily strong woman, but at the same time, the grief and mourning and loss was unfathomable. In the film, there's a scene when we go with her to enter the condominium apartment that Jamal had bought for them that was going to be their home. And she had not stepped foot in there since the murder about 6 months earlier. And I think that scene speaks for itself. You know, I don't think any of us can really fathom what that loss would be like.
What was a global reaction, if you would remind us, to the murder of Jamal Khashoggi? And how did it affect political and business ties to Saudi Arabia? And we should mention that Saudi Arabia is an ally of the United States.
Well, I mean, the global reaction was tremendous as the murder was unfolding. I mean, it captivated the world. You know, it was front page news. And Jamal was Time Magazine Person of the Year. I mean, it was a huge story. But the flip side of that, was there any meaningful action taken? And to date, here we are 2 years on, the answer is no. There have not been any true sanctions taken by the United States. The Trump administration has made it very clear that He did not plan to punish Mohammed bin Salman. He even bragged to Bob Woodward in audio that he saved his ass. But, you know, you see the same with other members of the G20. And, of course, you see the same with big businesses, be it Goldman Sachs or Chase, or in the case of this film, the dissident is being distributed independently through Briarcliff. It's in limited theaters, and it'll be available across video on demand on January 8th because the film did not receive a global streamer, be it Netflix, HBO, Disney, Hulu, Amazon, you know, all of these companies.
And that was because of the power of Saudi Arabia?
They have business or are doing business with the Saudis, and they're interested in subscriber growth. And what we're seeing is a global landscape that crimes like this can go unpunished as long as there's business to be done. And clearly their money and business interests are overpowering their human rights abuses, and that these companies and governments will look the other way in exchange for their money and investment.
So what do you think the future of global press freedom and speech looks like if governments continue to spy on and repress dissidents with impunity?
Look, we're in a very interesting situation that we're finding ourselves in at the end of 2020. Come through 4 years of, you know, of an administration that doesn't believe in press freedom, that doesn't believe in freedom of journalism, period. The Trump administration has spent 4 years attacking the press and attacking anyone who dare writes against it. So, you know, we're seeing this in our own country and are experiencing this. We're seeing this all over the world and in a reemergence of his tactics on top of the proliferation of fake news, and whether it's Facebook or QAnon or alt-right publications, it is becoming harder and harder to know what is true, what is false, because there is such a divide in opinion, whether it's fact or fiction. And this is happening in our own country, let alone in China, where, you know, you have the world's most populated country doing everything it can to repress and suppress free expression and free journalism and a free press. The same is happening in Brazil under Bolsonaro, of course, in Saudi Arabia and Emirates and many countries all over the world. So we take for granted that we have a free press, but it is truly under attack.
One last question. What is justice for Jamal Khashoggi?
Well, I think the concept that Mohammed bin Salman and the killers would actually stand trial is not realistic. But I think justice can take many forms. And in the current situation, I think justice is a re-examination of the U.S. and other countries' relationship with Saudi Arabia, essentially saying, yes, we want to sell you hundreds of billions of dollars in weapons or take your money for investment into our tech companies and other companies. But that will only happen once people like Loujana Hatoul and Assam Azamil and other thinkers and dissidents and human rights activists, Omar Abdulaziz's brothers and friends, are freed from your prisons. That will only happen when these sort of human rights abuses stop and their freedom of thought and opinion and journalism is allowed in the kingdom. I mean, I think that is the most realistic form of justice for Jamal. The Biden administration has said that it has very strong intentions to reassess that relationship and to sink sanctions and meaningful punishments. And I guess that will be determined in the coming months.
Brian Fogel is the director of The Dissident. It is in theaters now and will be available on demand January 8th. Okay, everyone, that is it for us today. I'm delighted to be pinch-hitting for Tanzina this week. Let us know what you'd like to hear from the show this week. We're at The Takeaway on Twitter, and I'm at Callie Crossley. If you want to talk with us, you can record a voice memo and send it to takeawaycallers@gmail.com.
And of course, you can call us also at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Also, the show is a podcast as well. You can grab that at thetakeaway.org or anywhere you get podcasts. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm Callie Crossley from GBH in Boston, and this is The Takeaway. See you tomorrow.
Want to weigh in on the biggest stories of the week? Sign up for our Listener Response Network. Just text the word START to 70101. Again, that's START to the number 70101. As always, standard data and messaging rates may apply, and you can text the word STOP anytime to opt out.